Senate please come to order? Will the members please vote to signify their presence?
The roll shows 11 members present this morning, Mr. President.
Please stand for the invocation by Michael Fieldhouse of the Juno Baha'i Faith.
O divine providence, this assemblage is composed of thy friends who are attracted to thy beauty and are set ablaze by the fire of thy love. Turn these souls into heavenly angels. Resuscitate them through the breath of thy Holy Spirit. Grant them eloquent tongues and resolute hearts. Bestow upon them heavenly power and merciful susceptibilities. Cause them to become the promulgators of the oneness of mankind and the cause of love and concord in the world of humanity, so that the perilous darkness of ignorant prejudice may vanish through the light of the Sun of Truth, this dreary world may become illumined, this material realm may absorb the rays of the world of spirit, these different colors may merge into one color, and the melody of praise may rise to the kingdom of thy sanctity. Verily, thou art the omnipotent and the almighty. Abdu'l-Bahá.
Senator Duncan, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Senator Taylor?
Move and ask unanimous consent that the prayer be spread upon the journal.
Without objection, the prayer will be spread on the journal. Senator Kelly?
Yes, unanimous consent, I be shown as present.
Senator Kelly, you will be shown as present, as will the other members that just came in. They're all being noted by the Secretary. Will the Secretary please certify the journal?
I wish to certify the correctness of the journals for the 72nd and 73rd legislative day.
Senator Taylor?
Move and ask unanimous consent that journals be approved as certified by the Senate Secretary.
Without objection, the journals will be approved as certified by the Senate Secretary. That brings us to introduction of guests. Senator Taylor.
Yes, it's my privilege today, Mr. President, to have with us in the galleries, I think there's some in both, several students from Blatchley Middle School in Sitka that have come over to take a tour of the Capitol and to have a chance to visit with us today. And my colleague, Representative Krusendorf, and I had a chance to meet with these young people this morning, and it's a real pleasure to have them present. If you could stand up when I call your name, We can then hold. Please stand up, and we'll hold the applause until we get done with everybody's name. Is it Tor Barkley or Tara Barkley? Tor. Oh, okay. Well, whoever's here then, Jennifer Fava, Carl Jordan, Twana Beer, Jill Phillips, Amanda Turner, Pam Reynolds, Andrew Atkinson, Roger Hames, Josh Studi, Pat Cernick, or Cerna, Cerna, okay, and Gabe Jones, Sylvia Gutermanson, or is it Cuttermanson? I'm getting closer. Well, this is worse. Jason DeGennaro, Jamie Bohr, Andrew Hames, Katie Hellam, Desiree Newell, Mike Schenke, Megan Poole, and Dossie Merkulif. Or Dory. I'm not sure how that would work. And I've got one other person that's, I think she's here. It happens to be her birthday. So let's all please welcome and join in celebrating Nicole Cox's birthday with her. Nicole is the redhead.
Senator Miller, under introduction of guests.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have a number of students in from Nenana and Clear with the close-up program. I think they're all in the Ziegler Gallery. But from Nenana, I have Mike DeRoche, Russell, let's see, get my list here, Deborah Spear, Russell Merrick, Jessica Black, Judy Blair, and from Clear, I have Joshua Tarrant, H.B. Teller, and the teacher, Jim McLean.
Further guests for introduction, Senator Salo.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have a constituent in the Miller Gallery here. She is with the Arctic Slope Consulting Group, and she's here for the RealCap Conference. I'd like you to help me welcome Maver Brown. Maver?
Senator Lincoln, under introductions.
Thank you, Mr. President. I also have some very distinguished guests, our future leaders in the Ziegler Gallery for the close-up students. Chris Gallen from Northway, Jeremiah Holbrook from Tetlin, Scott Sam from Tetlin, Karen Busby from Dot Lake, Carrie Goodman from Dot Lake, Carla Osdahl from Upper Kalskeag, Tana Deacon from Upper Kalskeag, and their teachers Richard Calkins from Northway and Shelley Larry from Upper Kalskeag. Please help me welcome them.
Further guests, Senator Duncan?
Thank you, Mr. President. On behalf of Senator Zaroff, who is not with us today, he's on state business, I'd like to introduce some young folks from his district who are here with the close-up program. We have some folks from CAKE, Dwayne Davis, who's a teacher, I think, is in the Miller Gallery, and students are Bob Lucero and Adam Davis from CAKE. From CLOOC, Don Bussey, who's the teacher, and in the Ziegler Gallery from CLOOC, we have Jody Anderson, Melanie Kralis, and Nicole Huggins. And from Craig, Jason Thronberry, and Jennifer Shapley.
Further guests, Senator Lehman.
Mr. President, in the Ziegler Gallery is an old friend of ours, former legislative aide, and a constituent of mine in the lives in the Spinard area, now a teacher in Greening, is it elementary or middle school? I don't remember where, in Eagle River, Kimberly Hummy, way in the back.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. President. I appreciate the member from Turnagain beating me to the punch there. I was going to introduce Kimberly as well as a former staffer of mine, but thank you very much for taking care of that. I'd also like to introduce to the body a couple of other friends of mine. I'm not sure if he's trying to stick his head in the gallery, and that's Robert Boyd, who's the executive president of AFECT, an organization in Mountain View and Anchorage generally that works with troubled families, and also a longtime friend and someone I consider almost a member of my family, Dorothy Garrett. Kimberly and Dorothy are both here with the teachers fly-in this weekend, so please help me welcome them.
Senator Krutula.
The rest of things, I don't believe the following people have been introduced this morning. Distinguished Alaskan educators and education advocates with the NEA Alaska, Jill Johnson and Layla Ayers.
Further guests for introduction? Messages from the governor.
Message dated March 22nd. Dear Mr. President, this letter is to approve the nomination of Stuart C. Hall as ombudsman for the state of Alaska. We look forward to the return of Mr. Hall to Alaska and the contributions he will make in this important position. Sincerely, Walter J. Hickel. Those are all the messages from the governor.
Messages from the House.
Message dated March 23rd. Dear Mr. President, the House has passed committee substitute for Senate Bill 77 Resources with the following amendments. House CS for Senate Bill number 77 Resources, MH, relating to the powers of the Board and Game into intensive management of big game to achieve higher sustained yield for human harvest, and returning for consideration.
Senator Taylor.
House committee substitute for committee substitute, Senate Bill 77 Resource amended House. I'm trying to figure out what I need to do now. I move that the Senate concur in the House amendments to Committee Substitute Senate Bill 77 Resource, thereby adopting House Committee Substitute Senate Bill 77 Resource amended House, and I recommend a vote of yes.
The motion before the Senate is, shall the Senate concur in the House amendments to Senate Bill 77 Resources amended House, thus adopting House Committee Substitute Senate Bill 77. Senator Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm wondering perhaps the sponsor of the legislation could go through the House amendments and what happened.
Senator Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. President. If the members would place the two versions side by side, I'll walk through the differences. New Section 1 regarding legislative finding was added in the House version, House Resources version. Secondly, the House version handles, quote, intensive management, unquote, by adding a new subsection E. Thus, existing subsection A that was in the Senate version is left unchanged. This was done to address the Department of Fish and Game's concern about the effect on items 1 through 10 that are in existing statute subsection A. The new wording proposed in the Senate version was addressed in the House version, new subsection E. And the additional descriptive words of, quote, prey, unquote, was added throughout this subsection to make more precise exactly what game animals would be subject to intensive management, namely identified big game prey populations. Moving on to line 5, page 2 of the House version, feasibly achievable was further clarified by adding the phrase utilizing recognized and prudent active management techniques. Thirdly, subsection E of the Senate version became subsection F in the House version as it was renumbered and was restructured to separately list when intensive management would not apply, and starting on page 2, line 15, 1A, is the wording pulled out of the Senate version but listed as 1A, ineffective based on scientific information. The next item where it would not apply is on page 2, line 16, 1B, inappropriate due to land ownership patterns. Both of those two were in the paragraph wording in the Senate version. Page 2, lines 20 through 23, item 2, is House language added to reaffirm allowances for emergency closures, and this was at the request of the department to make sure that that was understood. Fourthly, on page 2, starting on line 24, new subsection G becomes the definition subsection that was F in the old section on the renumbering. So G1, subsection G, item 1, the House added a new phrase and definition for, quote, identified big game prey populations. They felt that should be defined and did it. G2 becomes the definition paragraph for intensive management as it was defined in the, it was a definition item in the Senate version. I would note that the House version has deleted the definition paragraph for sustained yield that was in the Senate version, primarily at the request of the department. The two floor amendments added by the House are as follows. Amendment number 6 on the House floor, it shows on page 2, line 12. Page 2, line 12, after the word regulations, deleted the word providing and added or has scheduled for adoption at the next regularly scheduled meeting of the board regulations that provide. The reason being that there was some concern that simultaneous regulations may not be possible and that if intensive management was not possible to properly evaluate, we didn't want to hold up any triggering of the mandate for subsistence when the population levels are low. Amendment number 8 added a new wording on page 2, line 19, which is F1C, subparagraph F, item 1C. And that was against the best interest of subsistence uses or. Now, these are the structural and major changes between the CS for SB 77 Resources Senate and the House Committee substitute as amended on the floor. And Mr. President, I would urge that favorable consideration, I think, of possibly some of the concerns that was raised here has been on the floor, has been addressed in the House version, and I would urge the members to pass the House version for Senate Bill 77.
Senator Lincoln.
For a brief at ease.
Senate will stand at ease. Will the Senate please come back to order? Senator Sharp?
Call.
The Senate is under a call. Is there further debate while the call is being satisfied on concurrence with the House Committee Substitute, Senate Bill 77, Resources Amended House? We're waiting for the call to be satisfied. Was he excused till plenary time? Paul? Senator Sharp has lifted the call. The question before the Senate is concurrence in House Committee Substitute, Senate Bill 77, Resources Amended House. If there's no further debate, members may proceed to vote. Have all members voted? Does any member wish to change their vote? Would the Secretary lock the roll and record the vote? And so the Senate has concurred in the House amendments to Senate Bill 77, thus adopting House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 77, Resources Amended House, by a vote of 11 yeas to 8 nays. Madam Secretary.
Message dated March 21st. Dear Mr. President, the House has passed Senate Bill 242 with the following amendment. Page 1, line 8, after served, insert, and staffed by employees working 40 hours per week. And so, Senate Bill 242-MH, relating to office hours of state agencies, is transmitted for consideration.
Senator Taylor.
Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent. Senate Bill 242, amended House. what? That we shall concur in the House amendments to Senate Bill 242, thus adopting Senate Bill 242, amended House.
Yes.
And I recommend a vote of yes.
I thought
he was probably just objecting because I hadn't made a recommendation yet. Mr. President, the only change that was made to this legislation, which, by the way, was not requested by the sponsor, was a rather insignificant thing that sends a message. And the message is that maybe state employees should be working the same number of hours that the rest of the public is. I have no objection to them sending that message if they wish to do so. I don't think that the bill itself makes that then compulsory on all state employees. I think it takes additional legislation to accomplish that. But for those who feel that that's not appropriate, they, of course, should not vote for it. I think we probably should be working 40 hours per week instead of 37 and a half.
Senator Duncan.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. I think that's a topic that's probably worthy of debate and discussion, but not on this floor. I think it's a topic that should be discussed at the collective bargaining table. That's why we have the Paris statutes. That's why we enacted collective bargaining in 1972, so that those issues surrounding working conditions and hours and benefits and et cetera would be resolved at the collective bargaining table between union and management. And it's inappropriate for us to mandate the conditions of work when those are items to be collectively bargained. So I think it's inappropriate for us to support this piece of legislation with that proposal in it. The next question, of course, that has to come out is, what's the cost if we go to a 40-hour work week? It's probably going to cost more instead of less. And what is the real benefit of doing that? Those are the kind of items that need to be clearly looked at, carefully looked at, and discussed at the collective bargaining table. I think it's inappropriate for us to insert ourselves into that process. We have not done that in the past. I think if whomever made this amendment from the House side believes strongly in that, they can deliver that message personally to the head of the bargaining team on the state side and to the governor. And the administration can take that position at the collective bargaining table. For us to do it in legislation is not proper. Therefore, I believe that clearly this vote will define those of us who support the collective bargaining process and those who don't support the collective bargaining process. And I think that we've got to maintain strong support of a process that we put into place that some folks will say hasn't worked, but I think it has worked. It's removed the process that we were under for many years prior to collective bargaining, where it was political might and political pressure and no rational thinking that brought about changes in working conditions and employment status and level of wages for public employees. I hate to see us intrude in this area, and therefore I recommend that folks vote no.
Senator Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. President. To say that we have no right to insert ourselves in the collective bargaining process is silly. The bill gets sent to us. If this legislature is going to be able to afford to continue paying the number of state employees that I think the Senator of Juneau would like to have us keep having, we're going to have to send some messages, and that is that the people of the state, the people that I represent, I think the people that many of the districts represented here represent, perhaps not Juneau, but many of the people in the state believe state employees ought to be working 40-hour weeks, not 37 and a half. Now, we can quibble over whether it ought to be in statute or whether it ought to be in a resolution, but to say that we have no right to tell the governor and the collective bargaining units that we think they should be working longer hours, I find that reprehensible.
Mr. President?
Senator Taylor, you're flinching?
Well, reprehensible, kind of strong. I was just thinking that if we could, I'd like to move back up to introduction of guests. A good friend of many of us has just moved in, walked into the gallery, and that would be possible.
Senator Taylor, under introduction, yes.
I'd like to introduce dear friend Don Harris. And I don't think anybody ever told him that he could work less than 40 hours a week.
Mr. President,
Senator Couture.
On the same issue, I was just thinking deja vu. I remember Don Harris and our arguments on the minimum wage bill when I first was in the legislature, and here he shows up just in time for the 40-hour week discussion.
Back on the consideration of concurrence with Senate Bill 242, Senator Duncan.
Mr. President, in response to the finance co-chair's statement, you know, it may be appropriate for the legislature to tell the administration we would like you to negotiate the following items or take that position, but to do it in legislation saying that these offices shall be manned by, as I read it, by employees working 40 hours per week, that's intruding into the collective bargaining process, and that is inappropriate. And I guess I would only say, if you're going to support this, then we need to know how much it's going to cost, and the budget plan has to reflect that. It's either going to cost more money, or it's going to mean laying off of employees if the agreements don't change, which is going to mean less services delivered. So if this is a position you're going to take, you need to know what the outcome is going to be, and clearly that's why we turned this whole area over to the collective bargaining process, where you have a management team and you have an employee team, and they sit down and they evaluate the impact of various proposals that are put forward, proposals for increased wages, proposals for increased working time, proposals for flex time, right through the whole package. That's what should be done, needs to be done. It's inappropriate for us to insert ourselves into the process through this type of legislation.
All right, Senator Little.
Thank you, Mr. President. In looking over the bill, the change that's made, referencing a 40-hour work week, is only being related to state agency offices that are intended to provide services directly to the public. I suppose we can assume then that agencies that don't provide services directly to the public would not be included here. I just think this is not well thought out. This is not the proper way to address the problem or this issue, and so I can't support it, Mr. President, because even if what you are intending to do is require all state employees to work 40 hours per week, this change does not get us there.
Senator Lincoln?
Mr. President, I would have a question, I guess, of the author of the bill. In reading this, it says, and staffed by employees, the new edition, and staffed by employees working 40 hours per week. Does that mean that those offices, or maybe there aren't any offices that are open part-time that would not have this 40-hour work week? But the way I read this, it says now we're almost mandating that those offices, those public offices, state offices, shall be open for 40 hours a week, and I just am wondering if we have any offices, state offices throughout Alaska that are not open 40 hours a week.
Senator Taylor?
Yeah, I would certainly agree with my colleague from Fort Yukon. The I'm not certain why they chose to insert these words the way they did. I agree with also my colleague's comments from the peninsula. I don't believe that it accomplishes exactly what they thought they were going to accomplish, but I don't think it does any real disservice either. It just sends a message. But if you look at line 6, the legislation only requires the state to act to the extent practicable. And as a consequence, it would not impact a part-time office because it wouldn't be practical to do so.
Question before the Senate is, shall the Senate concur in the House amendment to Senate Bill 242, thus adopting Senate Bill 242, amended House, Senator Donnelly?
Can we have an at ease?
Senate will stand at ease. Will Senate please come back to order? Senator Taylor?
Yeah, I sincerely appreciate the at ease because I've had an opportunity to reflect further upon the legislation, and also the debate that has gone on the floor has been meaningful to me. And as a consequence, I would like to now change my recommendation and recommend that the members vote no, refusing to concur, so that this matter that has been raised by the other body can be properly addressed in a conference committee where we can make it work.
Thank you, Senator Taylor. Is there further debate? The question before the Senate is, shall the Senate concur in House amendment, thus adopting Senate Bill 242, amended House? Members may proceed to vote. Have all members voted? Does any member wish to change their vote? Would the Secretary lock the roll and record the vote? And so the Senate has failed to concur in the House amendment to Senate Bill 242 by a vote of 0 yeas to 19 nays. We'll send a message back to the House requesting that they recede from their amendment. In the event that they do not, I will appoint a conference committee with the chair to be Senator Taylor. Senator Phillips will serve, and Senator Little. Madam Secretary, we are under messages from the House still.
Yes. Message dated March 23rd. The House has passed and transmitted for consideration House Bill number 407 by Representatives Foster and Dewey, an act relating to issuance of commemorative Gold Rush motor vehicle license plates.
Transportation and Finance.
House Bill number 462 by Representatives Terrio and Cott, an act repealing certain provisions of the laws other than those in the Alaska Land Act relating to recording requirements, labor and improvement requirements, and size requirements for mining claims and providing for the suspension or waiver of state annual mining labor requirements when the federal government has suspended or waived federal annual mining labor requirements administratively or by statute and providing for an effective date.
Resources.
CS for House Bill 517, Judiciary by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to innocent misrepresentations by agents in real property transfers.
Judiciary.
And those are all the messages in the House.
Communications.
There are no communications.
Reports to standing committees.
Judiciary Committee considered Senate Joint Resolution number 36, proposing amendments to the Constitution of the State of Alaska requiring that candidates for governor and lieutenant governor receive more than 50% of the votes cast, recommends it be replaced with the committee substitute reports back as follows. Senator Taylor, Chair, and Senator Little sign do pass. Senator Donnelly sign no recommendation. Fiscal note, Senate Joint Resolution number 36 has a further referral to the Finance Committee. Finance Committee considered Senate Bill number 92 relating to an advisory vote during regional educational attendance area school board elections. Majority of the committee recommends the Community Regional Affairs CS be adopted and do pass. Report was signed by Senators Pearson and Frank co-chairs, concurring Senators Kelly, Rieger, Curtula, and Sharp. Fiscal note and zero. Fiscal note. Senate Bill number 92 has no further referral.
Rules.
Finance Committee considered Senate Bill number 248 relating to services for and protection of vulnerable adults. Majority of the committee recommends it be replaced with CS and do pass. Report was signed by Senator Pierce, Chair, concurring Senators Rieger, Sharp, and Curtula. Senator Kelly signed no recommendation. Zero fiscal note and fiscal notes attached. Senate Bill number 248 has no further referral.
Rules.
Finance Committee considered Senate Bill 250 relating to Older Alaskans Commission. Majority of the committee recommends it be replaced with a committee substitute and do pass. Report was signed by Senator Pierce, Chair, concurring Senators Kelly, Rieger, Curtula, and Sharp. Zero fiscal note. Senate Bill 250 has no further referral.
Rules.
Resources Committee considered Senate Bill 293, Native Allotments on State Land, Chair, the committee recommends do pass. Report was signed by Senator Miller, Chair, concurring. Senators Lehman, Pearson, Frank. Senator Donnelly signed no recommendation. Zero fiscal note. Senate Bill number 293 has a further referral to the Judiciary Committee. Judiciary Committee considered Senate Bill 295 relating to financial assistance for certain owners or operators of underground petroleum storage tank systems. Recommends it be replaced with the committee substitute reports back as follows. Senator Taylor, Chair, signed do pass. Senators Donnelly and Little signed no recommendation. Zero fiscal note. Senate Bill number 295 is a further referral to the Finance Committee. Labor and Commerce Committee considered Senate Bill 356, excluding certain recreational activities sanctioned by an employer from coverage provided under workers' compensation. Recommends it be replaced with the committee substitute and do pass. Report was signed by Senator Kelly, Chair, concurring. Senator Salo, Sharp, and Rigger. Senator Lincoln signed no recommendation. Zero fiscal notes. Senate Bill number 356 has a further referral to the Judiciary Committee. Finance Committee considered House Bill 3 relating to public home care providers. Majority of the committee recommends the Judiciary Senate CS be adopted and do pass. Report was signed by Senators Pearson, Frank, co-chairs, concurring, Senators Rigger, Catul, and Jackal. Fiscal note and zero fiscal notes. House Bill number 3 has no further referral.
Rules.
Judiciary Committee considered CS for House Bill 374 finance relating to reimbursable service agreements between state agencies for the purchase of services. Recommends do pass. Report was signed by Senator Taylor, Chair. Concurring, Senators Donnelly and Little. Previous House, zero fiscal notes. CS for House Bill 374 finance has a further referral to the Finance Committee. Judiciary Committee considered CS for House Bill 454 finance supplemental appropriation department law. Reports back as follows. Senator Taylor, Chair, and Senator Jackal signed do pass. Senators Donnelly and Little, no recommendation. CS for House Bill number 454 is a further referral to the Finance Committee. Rules Committee considered Senate Bill number 220, amending Schedule 2A of the Schedule of Controlled Substances. Recommends calendar. Report was signed by Senator Helfer, Chair, concurring Senators Rigger and Jackal. Rules Committee considered Senate Bill 266, extending termination date of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. Recommends calendar. Report was signed by Senator Helfer, Chair, concurring Senators Rigger, Little, Jaroff, and Jackal. Rules Committee considered Senate Bill 316, relating to commercial fishing penalties. Recommends calendar. Report signed by Senator Helfer, Chair, concurring Senators Rigger and Jackal. Senators Little and Jaroff signed no recommendation.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. President. I apologize for the interruption, but could we move to unfinished business, please?
Under unfinished business, Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move and ask unanimous consent that I be excused from the call of the Senate on for personal family business until Wednesday plain time.
Without objection, Senator Ellis will be excused until plain time Wednesday.
Thank you.
Madam Secretary.
These three bills appear on today's calendar, and those are all the standing committee reports today, Mr. President.
That brings us to reports of special committees.
There are no special committee reports today.
Introduction to Senate resolutions.
There are no resolutions.
Introduction to Senate bills.
Senate Bill number 365. By the Rules Committee, by request of the Governor, an act related to the improvement of state finances and fiscal accountability by increasing fees, by collecting additional revenue, by reducing certain program expenditures, by charging services or eligibility requirements for programs, by changing certain statutory limitation periods, by providing for the use of certain electronic records, by making changes to state agency functions or procedures, including certain reporting and planning procedures, and by authorizing extensions for state leases for real property if certain savings can be achieved and providing for an effective date.
State Affairs and Finance.
Senate Bill number 366 by the Finance Committee, an act relating to medical support for children, allowing a member of the teacher's retirement system or the public employee's retirement system to assign to a Medicaid qualifying trust the member's right to receive a monetary benefit from the system. Relating to the effect of a Medicaid qualifying trust on the eligibility of a person for Medicaid, relating to the recovery of certain Medicaid payments from estates and trusts, requiring persons who receive Medicaid services to be liable for sharing in the cost of those services to the extent allowed under federal law and regulations and providing for an effective date.
Finance.
Senate Bill number 367 by the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee, an act relating to health care and insurance for health care to review and approval of health insurance rates and rating factors relating to certain civil actions against health care providers, to coordination of insurance benefits and determination disclosure of fees paid to an insured or health care provider, to the rate of interest on certain judgments and decrees, to excise taxes on cigarettes, amending Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure 26, 27, 68, 79, and 82, and Alaska Rules of Evidence 802, 803, and 804, repealing Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure 72.1, and providing for an effective date.
Pass Judiciary and Finance.
And those are all the bills for introduction.
That brings us to the consideration of the daily calendar.
Senate Bill number 220 by Senators Ellis and Little, an act amending Schedule 2A of the Schedules of Controlled Substances applicable to offenses relating to controlled substances to add the drug methocainone, commonly identified as CAT. State Affairs Committee considered the bill, recommends a committee substitute and due cast. Report was signed by Senator Lehman Chair, concurring Senators Ellis and Miller. Zero fiscal note. Judiciary Committee considered the bill, recommends the State Affairs CS be adopted and due pass. Report was signed by Senator Taylor Chair, concurring Senators Helfer, Jack, O'Donnell, and Little. Rules Committee considered the bill, recommends calendar. Report was signed by Senator Helfer Chair, concurring Senators Rieger and Jacko. There's a State Affairs Committee substitute.
Senator Lehman.
Mr. President, I move the adoption of the State Affairs Committee substitute in lieu of the original bill.
Without objection, the State Affairs Committee substitute will be adopted in lieu of the original bill. Madam Secretary.
CS for Senate Bill 220, State Affairs, by the State Affairs Committee, an act amending Schedule 1A of the Schedules of Controlled Substances applicable to offenses related to controlled substances to add the drug methocainone, commonly identified as CAT. I have no amendments.
Senator Taylor.
Unanimous consent. Committee substitute Senate Bill 220, State Affairs, be considered engrossed, advanced from second to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Without objection, committee substitute Senate Bill 220 will be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
CS for Senate Bill 220, State Affairs, an act amending Schedule 1A of the Schedules of Controlled Substances applicable to offenses relating to controlled substances to add the drug methocainone, commonly identified as CAT.
Is there debate? If there's no debate, the question before the Senate is final passage on committee substitute, Senate Bill 220, State Affairs. Members may proceed to vote. Have all members voted? Does any member wish to change their vote? Will the Secretary lock the roll and record the vote? And so committee substitute, Senate Bill 220, State Affairs, has passed the Senate by a vote of 16 yeas to 0 nays. Madam Secretary.
Senate Bill number 266 by Senator Lehman, an act extending the termination date of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives relating to the scope of practice of certified direct entry midwives and providing for an effective date. Labor and Commerce Committee considered the bill, recommends it be replaced with CS and due pass. Report was signed by Senator Kelly Chair, concurring Senators Rieger, Sharp, and Salo. Finance Committee waived. Rules Committee considered the bill, recommends calendar. Report was signed by Senator Helfer Chair, concurring Senators Rieger, Little, Sharp, and Jacko. There's a Labor and Commerce Committee substitute.
Senator Kelly.
President, I move and ask unanimous consent for the adoption of the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute.
Without objection, the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute will be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
CS for Senate Bill 266, Labor and Commerce, by the Labor and Commerce Committee, an act extending the termination date of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. I have no amendments.
Senator Taylor.
Move and ask unanimous consent. Committee substitute Senate Bill 266, Labor and Commerce, be considered engrossed, advanced from second to third reading, placed on final passage.
Without objection, committee substitute Senate Bill 266, Labor and Commerce, will be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
CS for Senate Bill 266, Labor and Commerce, an act extending the termination date of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives.
Is there debate? If there is no debate, the question before the Senate is final passage of committee substitute Senate Bill 266, Labor and Commerce. Members may proceed to vote. Have all members voted? Does any member wish to change their vote? Will the Secretary lock the roll and record the vote? And so committee substitute Senate Bill 266, Labor and Commerce, has passed the Senate by a vote of 16 yeas to 0 nays. Madam Secretary.
Senate Bill number 316 by Senators Halper, Jacko, Cotulla, Miller, Frank, and Pierce, an act relating to commercial fishing penalties. Resources Committee considered the bill, recommends it be replaced with a CS, and reports it back as follows. Senator Miller, Chair, and Senators Pierce and Frank signed due pass. Senators Donnelly, Jarf, Adams, and Lehman signed no recommendation. Fiscal note. Finance Committee considered the bill. Chair of the committee recommends the resources CS be adopted and due pass. Report was signed by Senators Frank and Pierce, co-chairs, concurring Senators Sharp, Jacko, and Kelly. Senators Rieger and Cotulla signed no recommendation. Rules Committee considered the bill, recommends calendar. Report was signed by Senator Helfer, Chair, concurring Senators Rieger and Jacko. Senators Little and Jarop signed no recommendation. There's a resources committee substitute. Excuse me.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move and ask unanimous consent that the resources version substitute be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Without objection, the resources committee substitute will be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Committee substitute for Senate Bill 316, Resources, by the Resources Committee, an act relating to commercial fishing penalties. I have an amendment number 1 by Senator Adams, page 2, lines 16 through 22, and it's been distributed.
Senator Adams.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move amendment number 1.
Amendment number 1 has been moved. There is objection. Senator Adams.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's just a simple amendment, but it takes some time to follow. I have for each member is placed on their desk the Alaska Statute sections 44, 440 up to, should go up to 950, but I wanted you to at least look at what this amendment tries to eliminate. And so my concern with this piece of legislation has to do with section number 2, and this is why I would like to delete it. My first concern is that we have a statute here that is grossly inconsistent in the mental state required to have violated the law. And if this was the case, I was hoping that this piece of legislation would at least be looked at in the Judiciary Committee, which they would address some of this. This statute says that a person has to commit the violation without the copulation mental state. Yet when one reviews the string of statutes attached to the criteria that I have passed out to each one of you, the mental state for some is precisely the opposite. Specifically, and if you look at Alaska statute, which I handed, 1605-665, falsification of application for license, the mental state required is exactly the opposite. It says that a person has to have knowingly made false statement. If that is the case, I would appreciate someone explaining how you can knowingly make a false statement and at the same time not have a culpable mental state. Frankly, I think it's impossible. This is not only the statute that contradicts the intent required. If you look at Alaska Statute 1605-690B, it says that a person may not knowingly enter false information on a ticket. The same reasoning applies here. You cannot knowingly lie and at the same time not have a comparable mental state. Furthermore, I believe, in my view, the level of fines imposed with this bill reaches the point of penalty that throws this into what we would call a criminal arena. I would like to quote from you from a 1985 appeals court on this issue. It's Barron's versus the state. In that case, the court referred to a certain fishing fines being so heavy that they indicated criminalization. I quote from that case, in the Supreme Court's view, in an adverse judgment following the penalties under consideration serves to brand the defendant with the same stigma as a misdemeanor conviction, then the penalties are criminal penalties, and the defendant is entitled to the assistance of the counsel and the right of a jury trial. Further, in 1980, the Supreme Court addressed the fact that the penalty of $5,000 per fish violation indicated criminalization, and that this deserved further consideration. This bill goes up to $12,000 fine in this section, is over twice that the court has expressed concern over. The deeper flaw with this section is that it presumes a punishment fits for those in lucrative fisheries, and that equals the cost of entire fishing permit in some areas of our state. I think that we can all agree that the going price of a limited entry permit reflects the expectations for the value of fisheries for the next year. We can look at the February prices of various limited entry permits across the state. For instance, in out of Nome and Norton Sound, for a permit it costs $7,000. In a permit in my hometown, $11,000. Upper Yukon, $10,000. Then we look at permits in different parts of the state. Southeastern herring permit, it'll cost you $185,000. Northern Southeast Sable Longline, $151,000. In Bristol Bay, approximately $180,000. Chignik, $344,000 if you wanted to buy a permit. So this bill is imposing a fine for a mere violation that reaches the value.
of the fisherman's whole permit in some areas of the state, and that equals only 3% of the permit level value in other states. Now let's look at the gross earnings for the 1992 fisheries. In my hometown for 92, the average gross earnings were $4,195. Mind you, this is before that expenses were deducted. During the year, the average gross earnings for the Cook Inlet set net fishery was $50,000. The average gross earnings in Bristol Bay were approximately $98,139. Between Kotzebue and Bristol Bay, the earnings level is over 20 times greater in Bristol Bay. And this bill is setting a fine level that reflects the higher level for violations during and within the same occupation. I think it is a fundamental unfair to have a fine level for violations such as not renewing your license that you can fine up to $12,000, or registering your vessel on time that exceeds your annual income. I think that in good conscience, two things should be done with this particular statute. First, the fine level should be reworked to reflect a percentage of either the fisherman's permit value or their gross earnings. Next, the internal inconsistency in the statute should be corrected so it is clear whether someone is of guilty mind or whether they committed these violations. I think this bill should be moved to judiciary. I think my amendment is reasonable and it should be voted on.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. President. This was discussed in committee. To some extent, this amendment here would just take this section out of the statute and leave it as it currently is, so it doesn't address some of the problems that the senator from Kotzebue has about how the fine or how it's dealt with in coming to the fine. But basically what his amendment would do would go back to current statute and leave a $3,000 and $6,000 fine. But I think you have to go to lines 19 and 20, and it's punishable by a fine of not more than $6,000 or $12,000. So there's a lot of discretion there when they go to doing these fines. And testimony that we did have in committee is that very seldom is these levels reached in fines, and the department is very supportive of the increase in fines because they say, sometimes they're out there and they're taking somebody in, and as soon as they see the boat gone, everybody goes across the limit or whatever they're doing. So they need some deterrent out there, and they feel that this is a way to help in the deterrent. But I think you have to realize that this is the maximum ceiling that they can go in. It's not a floor. So there's a difference there.
Senator Adams?
And if that's the case, I would like to ask the resource chairman, if I would go back and look in the statutes then and look at 1605-665, a statute that pertains to knowingly putting false information on an application for a license. How could you knowingly put false information but not have the culpable mental state, even if that is possible, even if you knowingly did and you could find under that statute up to $1,000, but if you don't intend to, you could be fined then $6,000. I think there's a flaw in that statute and how you make the determination on these fines.
Senator Taylor.
If, in fact, there is a flaw in the statute, the flaw has been there since 1988. The part of the statute that my colleague is concerned about is, in fact, not changed. That is existing law. The question of whether or not you have a culpable mental state is clearly reflected as the intent of the language. When you look to the title, and it talks in terms of strict liability for commercial fishing penalties. And the reason this penalty or this mental state was inserted here was to avoid cases that had come down wherein the fisherman could not be proven to have intentionally violated the law, and as a consequence, the case was thrown out. Some of these cases were somewhat egregious out there in the bay, involving quite a bit of money and quite a bit of fish, And as a consequence, the legislature at the time chose to impose a higher standard upon the commercial fishermen, and that's where this section of the law came from. I agree with my colleague that it becomes confusing when you attempt to address the phrase, who without any culpable mental state violates, and then look to some of the provisions, and you find that those provisions call for a very specific mental state. In other words, intentionally lying on an application certainly requires a very specific mental state that must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to hold someone liable for such an offense. In that instance, there is a phrase in the law that talks about where we have a general penalty and then we have a specific penalty, or standard, I should say, not penalty, but a standard, that the specific will control over the general. And that's what's occurring here. Within this entire array of statutes from 05440 to 05690, there are two or three of them that do require a specific mental intent. And to the extent that they require that, that specific statute prevails over this generic provision. Where there is no specific culpable mental state intended by the law, then this provision takes care of that, so that it allows for the prosecution of those people under this strict liability provision. The main change being made by this section is not the standard by which someone might or might not be prosecuted. That has remained the same since 1988. The part that is being changed is solely the authority available to the magistrate or the district court judge who would hear the case to impose a penalty of up to $6,000 and up to $12,000 for a second or subsequent offense, where today they are limited to up to $3,000 and up to $6,000. I can tell the members from my own personal experience when I was on the bench and acting as a magistrate supervisor and assisting magistrates, that my dear friend Charlie Shawback out there at NACNAC was very frustrated when he would have people come into his courtroom, write out a check for $3,000, put it on his desk and laugh and say, "That's okay, Charlie, I still made $18,000 after I paid you," by going across the line. That was not good for the fishery. It certainly was not good for the honest fishermen, and it's something that I think provisions like this will help in the future to alleviate.
Senator Adams.
Yes, my colleague from Ketchikan, being on a judiciary committee, states that there is a flaw since 1988. Then perhaps that we should make that correction today, instead of letting this bill go by as a flawed bill, and make these corrections. And I say we can start then with this amendment. But would my learned colleague, with his personal experience on a bench, agree that a ruling by the Supreme Court stated that any time you get fines between $5,000 and $12,000, that they are no longer misdemeanors, there will be criminal penalties for some of our fishermen?
Senator Jackal.
Mr. Chairman, although I can relate to and understand the concern of my colleague from Kotzebue, who alludes to the different values in the fisheries, I would hope that that the prosecution does use the discretion that's allowed for in the legislation, but I'd have to say, Mr. President, as a participant in the fishery, that as the resource becomes less and less valuable, those people who over the good years over-capitalized and have exceedingly high break-even points, there seem to have less and less regard for the law. There are instances where I've heard reports of fishermen who often work in groups, who have formed pools, who pooled their money. In the instance of whether or not they got caught, they would take the money out and pay the fine. And it pays. I mean, you know, it's worth it to pay a fine of $3,000 or $6,000 when you get a boatload of $14,000 or $20,000 worth of fish on a daily basis. You maybe get caught once a week. You still have a good season at the end of the year. So, you know, with the fines at only at the level that they are, and it's not only a problem of the fines, we also have a problem of prosecution, not pursuing the higher fines and using their discretion in those fisheries where there are more valuables. We do have a problem there, too, but I would contend that it would most definitely be a deterrent to know that you could be fined up to $12,000 from $6,000 to $12,000. Those people who do participate in the fishery, who do attempt to participate in the fishery legally, never consider a violation as a mere violation. Those who try hard to participate legally always consider someone who violates as a very serious offense and rightfully a criminal offense.
Question before the Senate is the adoption of Amendment Number 1. Senator Adams.
Thank you, Mr. President. Then perhaps what is wrong then, perhaps, if we just put in a fine that is a monetary figure, then perhaps that we should then look for an amendment that gets a percentage of what you take up on a daily basis. If you're going to violate the law on a daily basis, that was an example was given, then perhaps we should have a fine that takes a percentage of their daily basis, of their annual or their annual profit versus what they have. I think that this bill needs a couple amendments, if that's the case, by the statements that were made on the floor.
Senator Lehman.
Mr. President, my friend from Kotzebue, in the handout that he gave us, if you look at Part B, the court does have the authority to order forfeiture of any fish, and it's my understanding that that is done when they can be caught. If you can catch them and cite them before they get rid of the fish and sell them elsewhere, but I would suggest that what the senator from Wrangell is saying is that these fishermen, and Mr. Schaubach was saying, is they sold them, got rid of them, and made the money and took the chance. But the court does have that authority and should be doing that in addition, so there is no benefit to people breaking the law.
If there's no Senator,
Mr. Chairman, it isn't specifically addressing the amendment of the Senator from Kotzebue, but since he brought the point up of a percentage basis on a daily, as per daily catch, the legislation does address that in Section 3, where it increases the standard from preponderance to clear and convincing, so it makes for keeping the fish that you have on board or at the site. So it's more likely that you will have a higher fine that day if you have more fish that day, because the standard has been increased. So it does address the concern.
Senator Taylor.
Yeah, I did not mean to disregard the comment of my good colleague, because I think he did make one point that is very important here. That is that, and it hasn't been responded to yet, Provision C within that statute provides that a person charged with a violation under this section is entitled to a trial by court, but not by jury, and is not entitled to representation at public expense. I think the Supreme Court case he cited is accurate, and I think the implication is accurate, and that is that we may very well, as judges reach to higher limits, start moving from the simple violation provision and into a penalty of sufficient criminal gravity regarding forfeiture of a license or a privilege or a sufficient monetary penalty, that in fact the court may find that this provision would not be appropriate to apply. That can be taken care of by the trial court itself at the time. If the trial court in fact intends to do so, to impose a fine of this magnitude in light of the Supreme Court's opinion, the trial court could afford that person a jury trial and could afford that person the right to be entitled to representation at public expense, and do so through its inherent power to make certain that justice is done regarding that individual, as opposed to compliance with this provision. Because this provision does not preclude that from occurring. It only says that he is not entitled by matter of right under this statute to a jury trial or to representation. But the magistrate or judge at the time could correct that problem. If in fact it is one, our Supreme Court may very well be to the place now where with inflation, $12,000 may not be that high of a standard. I wouldn't want to try and second guess them at this point.
Senator Adams.
Thank you, Mr. President. With that statement, then I believe the intent of this legislation was to get it out of misdemeanor and up to a real criminal type of penalties in the case of this bill, and I assume by my colleague's statement.
Question. Senate will stand at ease. Will the Senate please come back to order? The question before the Senate is the adoption of Amendment Number 1. If there's no further debate, members may proceed to vote. Have all members voted? Does any member wish to change their vote? Would the Secretary lock the roll and record the vote? And so Amendment Number 1 has failed to be adopted by a vote of 3 yeas to 12 nays.
I have no further amendments.
Senator Taylor.
Move and ask unanimous consent. Committee substitute Senate Bill 316, Resources, be considered engrossed, advanced from second to third reading, placed on final passage.
Without objection, committee substitute Senate Bill 316, Resources, is considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
CS for Senate Bill 316, Resources, an act related to commercial fishing penalties.
Senator Catula.
It has occurred to me during the debate that if in fact the legislation or this bill passes, it probably would be reconsidered, and during that period, maybe we ought to collectively or individually consider at least a legislative intent to speak to the court about the subject which was brought before us by a distinguished senator from Consulville. It may be that legislative intent in this area would be of some small direction to the court that where there's a $4,000 income, it seems rather ridiculous to do 3 years' income as a fine, where in another area it might be 10% or less. I think that at least a letter of intent would be a minimum wise to impose and give some tiny direction and suggestion to the court that way if we're going to write this law.
Senator Taylor?
I would certainly agree with my colleague regarding that, were it not for the fact that at this point we're dealing with a Supreme Court case that I believe was decided in 1980. And so we've got over 14 years of inflation and experience that has occurred. Furthermore, I do believe it's within the court's authority to provide for additional protections to individuals above and beyond what the statute may provide for, without doing any disservice to the legislation. So as a consequence, I think it's curable if it needs. I don't personally believe that it would need a letter of intent. And in fact, a letter of intent might further confuse the issue, since a major policy call would be made here regarding avoidance of a statute that's very clear on its face on the books. So I think that we would only confuse the issue by entering into such a letter.
Senator Catula.
But aren't we involved here in something that's serious and important on one hand, and I think we ought to attest to, but in fact we may be to some extent creating a problem that's unnecessary to create for some people that are in the low income brackets and the low income fishery. So while I'm very supportive of the legislation, that new facts brought before us, and I think maybe it ought to be attested to. It's a bothersome one to me now. And again, I have reached no. I'm really tired of people exploiting the fishery or making them. You know, there's an awful lot of people coming out of San Pedro that just delight in doing this, for instance, not alone our own local residents. And confounded, it ought to be stopped to the extent that we can. And we're never going to have enough. Police out there, particularly in the bay, and enough support, enough magistrates, and so on. But more and more abuse leads to a guy who's got to make a living. He's going to go over and abuse the system too. Okay, that supports the legislation. On the other hand, you have the problem that was cited by the Senator from Cosby, and I don't see collectively why we couldn't attest to it, at least after this bill is reconsidered.
Senator Catula, I will give you a copy of the information that I had on the Court of Appeals limitation on sentences, but without engaging in the debate, I can just say that they have said that the maximum sentence is reserved for the worst of the class of acts that sentence covers. So I think the Court of Appeals would not uphold maximum sentences in ridiculous interpretations, but...
Majority leader has not been tested for that.
The question before the Senate is final passage of committee substitute Senate Bill 316, Resources. Members may proceed to vote. Have all members voted? Does any member wish to change their vote? Would the secretary lock the roll and record the vote? And so committee substitute Senate Bill 316, Resources, has passed the Senate by a vote of 13 yeas to 2 nays. Senator Curtula.
I'd give notice my intent to reconsider my vote on Senate Bill 316, it is.
Senator Curtula has given reconsideration on committee substitute Senate Bill 316, Resources. Madam Secretary.
Citations honoring Rosemary Autumn-Rook, Senators Adam, Jaroff, Salo, Donnelly, Little, Duncan, Pierce, Lincoln, Ellis. Honoring Patricia Marlowe, Senators Halford, Phillips, Lehman, Jaroff, Salo, Duncan, Pierce, Lincoln. In memoriam, Betty Taylor, Senators Halford, Jaroff, Donnelly, Duncan, Pierce.
Senator Taylor.
I move and ask unanimous consent the citation calendar be approved.
Without objection, the citations appearing on today's calendar are approved. That brings us to unfinished business. Under unfinished business, Paul Glavinovich will not be able to serve on the Alaska Minerals Commission, so at this time I'm appointing Don Stevens of Anchorage to that position on the Alaska Minerals Commission. Is there further unfinished business? Senator Donnelly, under unfinished business.
Move and ask unanimous consent to be excused from the call of the Senate on March 25th.
Without objection, Senator Donnelly will be excused from the call of the Senate on March 25th. Senator Sharp.
Thank you. If this is the right place, Mr. President, I'd like to ask unanimous consent to be a cross-sponsor on House Bill number 407, Act relating to the issuance of commemorative Gold Rush motor vehicle license plates.
Without objection, Senator Sharp will be added to 407. Senator Curtula.
Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent to be excused from the call of the House on Monday to plain time Tuesday. I may not utilize the call exception, but I may need it. Thank you.
Without objection, Senator Curtula will be excused from the call of the Senate on Monday and until plain time Tuesday morning. Senator Jacko, will the Senate please stand at ease? Will the Senate please come back to order? We're under unfinished business. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to be excused from the call of the Senate on Monday through Monday morning plain time.
Without objection, Senator Miller will be excused from the call of the Senate on Monday through Monday morning's plain time.
And if we could also go back up the calendar, introduction of guests.
Without objection, we're
I have a good friend in the gallery from Nenana. She's the director of the Nenana Senior Citizen. She's down with the Older Alaska Commission, Margaret Sanders.
Senator Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. President. Turning around and noticing that I also have a guest in the gallery today, down visiting from Anchorage. I believe she's actually a constituent of Senator Kelly's, but visiting us is my sister-in-law, Kathleen Doyle.
Senator Kelly.
I have a constituent here. It's either your constituent or Senator Phillips' constituent, the wife of a good friend of ours, former Representative Bob Bradley, Marsha Bradley.
Senator Lehman.
Mr. President, while we're introducing, I don't know which district he lives in, but he used to, maybe still does, teach at Diamond High School. Rob Pfister in the Ziegler Gallery, and that used to be in my House district. Got to know him then. Welcome to the Senate.
We are back under unfinished business. Is there further unfinished business? Announcements? Under unfinished business, Senator Pierce.
Please, and move and ask unanimous consent, I be excused from the call of the Senate from 5 p.m. Thursday, March 31st, until plain time Tuesday morning, April 5th.
Without objection, Senator Pierce will be excused as requested. Announcements. Senator Sharp.
Mr. President, I would announce that the Senate Transportation meeting originally scheduled for this afternoon at 3:30 has been canceled, just a reminder, and will be the bill's schedule will be heard that time, will be rescheduled at a later date.
Senator Kelly.
Labor and Commerce meeting that is usually held at 1:30 that was put back to 1 o'clock today will be held at 1:15 in the belt room. That will give everybody time to get a sandwich before the meeting.
Further announcements? Special orders? Oh, under announcement, Senator Cruz?
Sorry. Yeah, finance tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and again Saturday morning at 10 o'clock.
Senator Curtula, under announcements.
No.
So there's no further announcements, special orders?
You want a special order?
Senator Curtula?
Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent for the briefest of comments on the historic events of Prince William Sound.
Senator Curtula.
Mr. President, I think today is the fifth anniversary of the major spill. And indeed, in the Prince William Sound area, there's been an awful lot of change from the time in which there was one small vessel that was up on props with a badly damaged tank that was being welded when the spill occurred. And I can remember the dozens and dozens of calls I personally had from the fishing community of Cordova, and particularly when nothing could be done, nothing was done. They'd go out there and go around the oil spill. I was there before it was dissipated, of course, a local resident politician, and it was a disaster. I, of course, spoke to the many people involved over the many years, and I might say the company involved as quickly as was humanely possible, considering that there weren't booms and anything available even in the United States at times, had to go to Scandinavian countries and so on. You know, they spent the money and did what they could to rectify the problem. So Prince William Sound is moderately to very well being watched, but there's an awful lot of the rest of the shoreline of Alaska. And, of course, nothing's ever been resolved for the Western Arctic, where there will be drilling and where there will be ice packs and where they don't know how to handle spills in that condition. And quite frankly, I don't think this is the time for us to have people revising history nor ignoring what's a potential spill, potential spill in other areas of Alaska that aren't really going to be monitored adequately. We don't even have sufficient to back up to suggest what might be needed to be done. And I just bring this to our attention because there's a lot of legislation floating around here. Some of it that if we don't pass, we'll short us some funds. Some of it if we do pass, we'll perhaps short us some funds too. Let's not totally forget the anniversary by ignoring what may happen in the rest of Alaska if we're not proceeding with caution. Thank you.
Further special orders? Senator Adams?
Yes, Mr. President, may I have the floor to give my senator's speech on the same subject?
Senator Adams, you have the privilege of the floor to give your senator's speech on the same subject.
Yes, thank you. 5 years ago, the Exxon Valdez crashed into Bligh Reef and changed forever the lives of the people of Prince William Sound and all of Alaska. Although we have learned from the devastation caused by this tragedy, we must not sink into complacency. Clouded judgment, negligence, and an unprepared bureaucracy allowed this to happen. As a legislature, as citizens of this great state, we must remain protective of our resources and a vigilance against the reoccurrences. Prince William Sound continues to feel the effects of the oil spill in every way, from the tough economic times in Cordova to the empty subsistence beaches near Chinica Bay. Whittier has not recovered from the impact of the cleanup. Valdez cannot provide housing for the new workers, arriving daily to correct problems at the terminal. The people of Tetitlik look at the Bayou each day and wonder about their future. 5 years later, there is still no agreement as to what damages was caused by the oil spill. The scientists do not agree. The bureaucrats do not agree. The state and federal oil spill trustees do not agree. Be assured, however, the people of Prince William Sound do agree. There are fewer pink salmon. There is little subsistence food. There is still oil down the beaches. Today, as we observe the fifth anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, I urge each of you to travel to Prince William Sound as I have done. Take a walk on the beaches. Search for the sound of a seal. Listen to the silence of the fishing fleet. Look into the eyes of the people of Prince William Sound and then ask yourself, have we seen enough? Have we learned enough? Have we done enough? Others have marked the anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill with seminars, public meetings, and candlelight vigils. Let this legislature do more. Let us commit to prevention. Let us commit to response. And above all, let us commit to remembrance. And that was Senator Lincoln's speech that she couldn't give due to a medical appointment.
Senator Rieger, under special orders.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. Move and ask unanimous consent to speak briefly on health care.
Without objection, Senator Rieger on health care.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. I think in looking at the proposals that have been advanced at the national level and at the state level regarding health care reform, there is a large group of proposals which are intended to improve the efficiency or otherwise lower the cost of delivering health care to individual Alaskans or individual Americans. And a lot of these proposals can be taken one by one and reviewed on their merits and advanced for legislative consideration. One other issue which doesn't speak as directly to the efficiency or cost of health care is the question of how you offer coverage to all individuals or how you pool the risk of individuals who are covered in an effective way. And this is a whole separate part of the health care debate. And it's been my observation after holding committee hearings and reading up on it that this is the area where we need the most additional information. You don't really know what consensus there is in our state for universal coverage or mandatory coverage unless we know both what would be in that coverage and what it would cost. Just yesterday in the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee, we had the director of the Division of Insurance, one of their chief actuaries, at the table and asked them what, for example, a catastrophic plan might cost. And they were really, they were just guesses. And I think, I'm not sure we have a very close estimate at all of what such a plan would cost. The problem that I think we're facing is that we cannot have an informed policy call on this separate issue, the issue of pooling of risks or offering universal or mandating universal coverage, until we know what those benefits in the plan and what the cost would be. There are two proposals that I think have the highest profile on the table in our committee, one which perhaps goes a little farther than I'm comfortable in jumping in, and one which has been described by some as not perhaps going far enough. So today, the Senate bill was just introduced, let me see, 367, offers a little bit of extra direction to a committee to consider a catastrophic plan and consider a basic plan, describe what the benefits would be, cost out what the cost would be, and bring it back to the legislature for our consideration. I think we need that information before we can make an informed judgment on going forward on that step. The other proposals, which are in a number of pieces of legislation before us, I think have been reviewed, and a lot of them make sense. These have to do with simplified administration, the uniform claim form, proposals regarding data collection, whether or not the Division of Insurance should have the authority to review and approve rates, disclosures of fees by medical care providers, methods for arbitration instead of going directly to court when there's a malpractice issue, some of the problems that involve the statute of limitations, especially with OB cases, disclosure or discussion of the methodology for setting usual and customary rates of reimbursement for healthcare claims. The same bill, Senate Bill 367, attempts to gather up a good number of those proposals and also put those forward for further review by the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee. I would like the members of the committee and also the members of the Senate to take a look at Senate Bill 367 and not regard that as something that the committee intends to move out without further debate, but as a further suggestion of something which I think is doable and makes sense for this year's legislature, and I hope to bring up hearings on it starting Monday of next week. Thank you.
Senator Pierce.
Thank you. I move an unanimous consent that I be allowed to have the floor to speak on some good news coming out of the fifth anniversary.
Senator Pierce, on good news.
Thank you. Last year at the beginning of the session, I introduced a bill, Senate Bill 75, which talked about reporting of tanker malfunctions. My bill was actually in response to the tanker Brer accident off the Shetland Islands, where a tanker lost power. And because of international maritime and salvage laws, the owners of the tanker refused to allow the captain to let the proper authorities know that he was in trouble until it was too late. While the crew was indeed saved from the tanker itself, as I'm sure we all remember, hit the rocks and a spill larger than the Exxon Valdez occurred on shore of the Shetland Islands. So I went ahead and put a bill in that would have given our own Department of Environmental Conservation some additional powers in trying to enforce tanker owners and letting proper authorities know if they were in state waters, if they were under distress. Unfortunately, because of the murky areas of international maritime law, the state of Alaska doesn't have the authority, we're told by the courts, to reach that far. However, what we do have the authority to do is work with the Coast Guard, and today the governor signed, along with a rear admiral of the U.S. Coast Guard, a memorandum of agreement that does solidify a partnership that's been growing since the Exxon Valdez. And we have an approach now where hopefully we'll work together on both prevention and responding to any sort of oil or hazardous substance spills in Alaska. The memorandum of agreement does a number of things. It says that the entities will share information. They will jointly plan for and respond to spills. They will also cooperatively work together to prevent spills, and while that sounds real, those six words sound real easy, it hasn't been that easy, and I think this will force some changes. Perhaps most important, it would allow the state of Alaska access to the National Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund that has $1 billion in it to pay state costs if we have to clean up future catastrophic oil spills. It will mean that the agencies will coordinate their enforcement action and also that they'll maintain close communications to reduce the conflict between each party's permits, directives, and instructions. And that's been one of our biggest problems. The state tells people they have to do one thing, and the Coast Guard tells them they have to do something, and the two things are oftentimes in conflict. It's too bad that it took a couple of major spills, one in our waters and one in the off the coast of the Shetland Islands, to have the Coast Guard working with the state on these sorts of memorandums of agreement, but I think we can all be thankful that they're in place now.
Senator Curtula, under special order.
President, I'd like to recomment briefly as a follow-up to Senator from Anchorage's brief statements on
Senator
healthcare.
Curtula on the health care question.
Thank you. First, wheels are reinvented and improved. I know that myself, since 1980, collected the files and the laws of the Western countries, Germany, which, for instance, very conservative, generally speaking, very capitalist country, has had health care since 1890. But the Scandinavian countries in Britain and the provinces of Canada. During that period of time, I wrote four or five laws that, together with the Senate, the HMO legislation, physician's assistant, and more recently legislation on that's some benefit to people that couldn't get insurance. I've been involved in it. I know something about the subject. So I'm going to touch base on catastrophic. Senator Tillian, with myself as co-sponsor, entered in my memory, wrote the present catastrophic legislation. Let me tell you how it was abused. It could have been improved on, and probably still legislation ought to be talked about. It was to provide with people that had a certain amount, or indeed didn't have anything, but by and large it provided assistance to those that had a certain amount of net worth, probably approaching middle age or older, and had cancer or heart disease, and hit a catastrophic situation, which we didn't want them to take everything, so they wouldn't lose their house at least, and maybe a little bit of a private sources of income for payment of this catastrophic problem that hit them. $100,000 problems are not rare, much more. We funded it, I think, a max of $1.6 million, $1 million plus, that's my memory. But the law was written so broadly that we got into premature babies, and the leading hospital in Anchorage, with its philosophical and religious connections, all tied into this thing, and they refused to even negotiate under the statute, as I remember it, on what would go to those to which we really intended the funds to go for, and at least in majority. They just took 100% of it at $300,000 or $400,000 a clip for one infant. And as a result, we just discontinued funding it. So don't ignore those. If you're getting back into this, don't ignore the wisdom and experience that we've had in this. It's very complicated. It isn't simple. And if you can figure in America, you know, God bless the capitalist system, but if somebody can find a niche in there, he's going to take you for all he can get. I don't care what the agency is or who the individual is, apparently, and when it comes into the medical health care field. So, boy, you're going to have to put a lot of time and effort into this if you're going to start something new. You're not going to get it done in a couple weeks.
If there's no further special orders, Senator Taylor.
Under special orders, privilege of the floor on history and transportation of fuel.
Senator Taylor.
The Commodore of the Coast Guard this morning was quoted when he was reminded of the fifth year anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, that he said, that's what you get when you rely on foreign oil. I hope he didn't mean that. Today is also the anniversary of the day that they closed down the largest blowout ever to occur on a drilling platform, at least in American waters. That occurred down in the Gulf of Mexico, right off of Texas. And that blowout pumped 126 million gallons of oil into the delicate ecosystem of the Gulf. Yeah, we lost about 7 million, I think, if my memory serves me right, the Exxon Valdez. But probably more important than that ancient history that nobody wants to remember on the Gulf, obviously. Instead, we've got idiots swinging off of boats in Europe so they can repaint the name. We have people wandering around with candles. We have a lot of people pouring ashes over their head and tearing in sackcloth to try and show how emotional we can become over an event that caused a great mess in our state. I don't join with those people who use exaggerated terms like catastrophe, disaster, etc. Because, Mr. President, this morning on the news, a 36-inch natural gas pipeline exploded in New Jersey. It destroyed 8 apartment buildings. The explosion left a crater 50 by 60 feet deep, 120 feet wide. It killed one person, severely injured 40. The buildings are still burning. They can't even get in to search for what may be several other bodies located within that building. They're talking about using dogs to find the bodies when the heat cools down. And the mayor of Edison, New Jersey, said it'll be a miracle if everyone escaped that burning building. I wonder where our friends in Congress were that are so concerned about our pipeline that has never killed anybody, as far as I know. Were they there? Are they going to show up in Edison, New Jersey, and hold congressional oversight hearings to investigate that 36-inch natural gas pipeline? To make certain that the officials of that state have a plan and have all sorts of booming material or whatever may be necessary to protect the citizens of Edison, New Jersey from such a catastrophe? Because you see, Mr. President, I believe when you blow up human beings and you kill them, that is a catastrophe, that is a disaster. I believe when you spill a bunch of oil, it's a mess, and you clean up a mess. Nobody's going to be able to clean up
and take care and rehabilitate the lady who died this morning when that gas pipeline blew up. Maybe we should all remember that today. Maybe we should remember what Saddam Hussein did. Is any group going to show up on Saddam Hussein's doorstep this morning with little candles and prayer vigils about Saddam Hussein's conduct? I don't think Red Adair has done putting out the fires yet that rascal started over there, and nobody's ever bothered to tell us what the environmental impact of the delicate ecology of the Gulf was when he opened up the valves and filled it full of oil. Yes, I appreciate the concern and significance of the fifth anniversary, but, Mr. President, I cannot share the emotional exaggeration that many people would give it. Thank you.
Senator,
I move and ask unanimous consent. The Senate stand in adjournment until 11 a.m. Monday.
We're adjourned until 11 a.m. Monday.